Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
I've got to go, Rock. It's all right. I'm not afraid. Sometime, Rock, when the team is up against it, when things are wrong, and the breaks are beating the boys, ask them to go in there with all they've got and win just one for the Gipper. I don't know where I'll be then, but I'll know about it, and I'll be happy.
That, Dominic Sandbrook, was the death of George Gipp, who originally was a very successful basketball player, then became a football player after his team coach saw him kick football an absolute mile. He was a great football star. And then very sadly, he got a throat infection and died of it at the age of 25. But the twist in this story, and people may be wondering why we're talking about this rather obscure football player, the twist, as I'm sure all our American listeners will certainly know, is that actually that wasn't George Gipp. That was Ronald Reagan playing George Gipp.
Right. And that was original footage, was it, Tom? That was
Yes, it was.
That was from the film Knute Rockne, All-American, 1940. That absolutely wasn't you.
No, it wasn't me. Well, you could probably tell it was me because obviously it was Reagan. I mean, it's a brilliant impression, but it was Reagan as he sounded in the 1980s. The problem is, whenever I think of Reagan, I think of Reagan as president because he was the first American president that I became familiar with.
Right.
And we punctuate, you know, not just Americans, all of us punctuate our lives with the American presidents who are in the background on the news and the newspapers. And Reagan was the first for me.
The Gipper.
Yeah. The Gipper. Yes.
And people called him the Gipper. I mean, people called him throughout his political career, people called him the Gipper.
Because before he became president, long, long before he became president, he was a movie star.
Yes.
And before he became a movie star, he played a lot of sports.
Yeah, he did. Well, he didn't just...
And he was a kind of TV commentator. Well, he was Alan
Partridge.
He
was a radio commentator.
Yeah.
Yes, and an extremely successful one. Yes, hello, everybody. Welcome to The Rest is History. We are embarking on an epic journey through the life of Ronald Reagan. So our last epic journey, Tom, was through the career of Christopher Columbus.
So now another great American.
Another great American, yeah, exactly. So Reagan has a really extraordinary life, doesn't he? I mean, it allows us to talk about so many different things. So growing up in the Midwest, the world of the early days of radio, Hollywood, the Red Scares of the late 1940s, and then obviously going into politics in California, a big governor of California, and then the sort of tumult of the 70s, the rise of kind of populist conservatism, and then those sort of two terms. And Reagan, I suppose, has, I mean, even I know you're not a specialist in American history, Tom, but Reagan feels like a really consequential world figure, doesn't he, in a way that most American presidents arguably don't.
Well, he's got an airport named after him, hasn't he?
Yeah, Reagan National in Washington.
And that's absolutely a measure, I get. Well, no, I suppose it isn't, because Ford's got one and all kinds of people have, but it's a big one. I mean,
it's a big one. Yeah. It's not the Jimmy Carter peanut facility, or whatever, is it? I mean, no, and it's not just that. I mean, that sounds a bit like we're sort of being completely frivolous about it, but Reagan is also an ideological lodestar. So he's one of those figures that Republicans always invoke. I mean, rather like how British conservatives always lay claim to the mantle of Winston Churchill or Margaret Thatcher. Reagan fulfills that role in a way that, you know, among modern presidents, I suppose only Franklin Roosevelt and John F. Kennedy, they do for the Democrats. But Reagan stands alone, really, for the Republicans, maybe Abraham Lincoln, I suppose.
My sense growing up in a Europe that was haunted by the shadow of nuclear war, my sense of Reagan growing up was a very negative one. that he was a warmonger, that he was a dangerous cowboy. You remember Spitting Image, which was kind of satirical British TV show involving latex puppets. And there was a kind of running gag about Reagan that he would, he'd be looking for the button to press. Oh dear, I've pressed the wrong one. There goes Moscow.
Yeah.
And that was a kind of running gag that he just had to press the wrong button and Third World War would break out. And then suddenly he was kind of meeting up with Gorbachev in Geneva and Reykjavik and kind of even going to Moscow. And the Cold War seemed to be over. So there was that kind of tension, I think, in the memory that he was a cowboy who was out to, you know, shoot the bad guys and precipitate the Third World War. He was a man of peace who wanted to get rid of all nuclear weapons. So there's that ambivalence, I think, which is probably the overriding sense of ambivalence for people outside America. My sense of Reagan as a president within America is that he was a kind of a pretty terrible president in terms of his policy, but that in his role as a kind of constitutional monarch, which is also a very important part of the president's role, he was superb. And even people who were very ideologically opposed to him, who hated a lot of what his policies embodied, they liked him. He was a genial man. He was at moments of extreme stress in American life, think particularly of the loss of the space shuttle when it blew up.
The Challenger.
He was superb at channeling American grief and pride and all the complexities of it. But maybe I'm being a kind of sneery European perspective.
That does absolutely capture how a lot of Europeans think about Reagan. I think the difference, interesting for me as somebody who writes a lot about Britain in the same period, the interesting contrast obviously is with Margaret Thatcher, supposedly his great partner and soulmate, because they're very different, I would say, in temperament, in style, in tone. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher's so abrasive and so confrontational.
Nobody loved Mrs. Thatcher. I mean, a few did, perhaps.
If you were a very hardcore Tory, you would love Mrs. Thatcher. But she was uncompromising in her zeal for conflict and confrontation. I mean, she loved it. One of the things that emerges when you sort of study Reagan, the people around him say, the one thing about Ronald Reagan is he hated confrontation. And did all that he could, even with the Soviets. You see, the interesting thing is that Reagan is writing in his diary how he'd love to get in a room together with the general secretary and convince him, you know, that we mean them no harm and all this kind of thing. I mean, there is this sort of that emollience is not just skin. It's not just a performance. I mean, well, this is a thing we'll discuss that with Reagan. It is, of course, always a performance. He is the politician as performer par excellence. But the key to Reagan, it seems to me, is that he absolutely believes in his own performance. And to some degree, I mean, one of the interesting things about him when he's a film star is people always say he's at his best when he's playing himself. I mean, this the sort of mirrors within mirrors. You know, he has this fantasy image of what a president should be or what an American should be. And he's absolutely determined to play it, but he's never really aware that it's a performance, is he? He never lets you in on the. He's not like Boris Johnson, who's always winking and joking, and
or like Trump
drawing attention to the artifice. Reagan does an absolute sincerity to his portrayal of himself as the president.
Well, I think also, and again, this is perhaps a kind of foreign perspective on it, but he absolutely embodies so much that defined America in the 20th century to a startling degree. So in his memoirs, he talks about growing up with white picket fences, even though, as we'll find out, his upbringing was much more kind of darker than that, really. He plays sports at high school.
Yeah.
He does the high school romance. He goes to college. He is a lifeguard. He becomes a Hollywood actor. It's astonishing the degree to which he has within himself all these kind of ideals, these visions, these fantasies, these dreams that Americans have always had about themselves and the way that has served to define America in the eyes of the world. And he draws on all of that as a politician.
Yeah.
Superbly. But the question then is, which we've already fencing around, to what extent is it performative and to what extent is he what he seems to be?
Well, it's a fascinating question, isn't it? With politicians, you could argue that it's everything is always performative, but that's the point. That's not inauthentic.
I mean, it's so I've just got a list of comments here So this is a screenwriter called Irving Wallace in 1942, describing Reagan as a man who parrots things, shallow and affable. Richard Nixon to Henry Kissinger in 1971, pretty shallow. And then that's the charge throughout his presidency.
Yeah.
Is that basically he's a kind of a mannequin, or he's an actor speaking lines, and that people have to give him the scripts. And the question of as to whether there is any depth beneath that seeming shallowness is kind of interesting.
That's a fascinating one. And just as a spoiler, I don't think he is shallow. I mean, the interesting thing about Reagan, about the thing about the scripts, he writes those scripts. He absolutely believes, and as we'll come to in this episode, in Hollywood, he was notorious for being, you know, you wouldn't want to sit next to him at lunch because he would just bore you about world affairs and politics.
But, which he probably picked up from Reader's Digest.
Reader's Digest. Well, that's true. He picked up from Reader's Digest. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Anyway, so let's talk a little bit about Reagan's background, because this actually is a really interesting story, isn't it, Tom?
That's
so
fascinating.
So he's born in 1911, Tampico, Illinois, which one of his biographers, I think it's Bob Spitz, describes Tampico as, says it's basically like the set of a low-budget Western. So he's in the Midwest.
Right. And the whole way through his life, both the settings and the people around him are like people from films.
Yeah, they are. Even his parents are, actually, to some degree, aren't they? They are rather stereotypical. Jack Reagan and Nellie Wilson.
Well, or even before that. I mean, so they come from Ireland.
Yeah.
Via London, via Peckham, interestingly. And they go, they, you know, they become prospectors. So it's Little House on the Prairie, all that kind of stuff. His great uncles go gold prospecting, and two of them end up being eaten because they get stuck in a snowstorm.
Who eats them?
The other prospectors.
Okay. That's bad form, isn't it? I'd hope for better from my prospecting comrades.
But the idea of Reagan as a cowboy, I mean, his great uncles died in the Wild West at its wildest.
Yeah.
So that is all part of the background.
The funny thing is, even though he sort of dressed up as a cowboy on his ranch, he was always very cross when people called him a cowboy. And he said, I didn't do many Westerns. He did about seven Westerns or something. But that's a sign of that American iconography, how quickly people associated the two. And he himself, there are loads of photos of him in a denim shirt, kind of on his ranch with a horse.
So he grows up in the Midwest.
Yeah.
Don't you think that a huge part of his appeal is that he embodies an ideal of America that is associated with the Midwest?
Yeah.
It's kind of, it's virtues, it's hardiness, it's provincialism.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Couldn't agree more. I think he has a fantasy of America himself. He has at the core of Reagan is an idea of America, I think, that he completely and utterly believes in. And it's a very Midwestern idea. It's not the world of the coasts. It's not urban or metropolitan. It's not especially diverse or sort of multicultural.
Well, not at all, is it?
I mean, I guess we'll talk about Reagan and race a little bit later, but there are not many African-Americans in Reagan's early years. It's a world of small towns. If you've ever been, for our British listeners, if you've ever been, you know, to some of these places, to Illinois, to Iowa, to Minnesota, I mean, I lived for a year in Minnesota, you are a long way. You're an awful long way from anywhere. And there are these small towns with an enormous sense of civic pride, the kind of thing actually that in Britain we don't have at all and we automatically scoff at, where people make their own, they don't just make their own entertainment, but they make their own civic culture.
Yeah.
So, you know, Reagan's mother, for example, Nellie, we'll talk a bit more about her in a second, but she is absolutely one of these people who throws herself into the local community in a completely unironic way. You know, I'm going to join the church. I'm going to join the Amateur Dramatic Society. I'm going to do loads of charitable things. And that sort of small town world where everybody knows everybody else, you know, that fantasy, if you like, Reagan as a little boy completely imbibes that. And it would never occur to him to question it or to mock it or to do all these things, which as Europeans, we automatically do.
No. And in his memories of it, there's a, you know, it's the embodiment of, all these tales of, I suppose, kind of Mark Twain, going back to all that, the idea of, so he writes about there were woods and mysteries, life and death among the small creatures, hunting and fishing, that kind of idea that this is a paradise for a child. And, you know, that idea that a paradise has been lost is often there in conservatives. I mean, it's kind of a wellspring for conservatism in adult life. But the thing that's fascinating about Reagan is that it's not just, white picket fences, because there is also quite a lot of darkness.
Yeah. So his father, Jack, he's from Fulton, Illinois. As you said, sort of Irish background. He's a shoe salesman, which sounds kind of banal, but actually at the time, in the sort of 1910s, 1920s, the department store was king. And to be a salesman in the department store was a kind of, I don't want to oversell it. It's not a massive deal, but it's not nothing.
Bob Spitz, in his biography of Reagan, has the great phrase, he developed a flair for fitting the female foot.
What a thing to have as your epitaph. But he's tall, he's charming, he's gregarious. He's very political, actually. So the idea that Reagan, this obviously hangs over Reagan all his career, the idea that he's merely a puppet or a front man. He comes from quite a political family.
And the politics is Democrat.
Yeah, politics is Democrat, very interested in social causes, social issues, minimum wage, welfare, all that sort of stuff. Jack is, as an Irishman, he's almost automatically going to be a Democrat anyway, because politics in the late 19th, early 20th century is very sort of sectarian. But he talks about this at the dinner table. The cloud, of course, is drink. So Jack is,
yeah.
There's some question about whether he's an alcoholic or a binge drinker. As if you can sort of separate the two. He's definitely a binge drinker, and he drinks a lot. And this is clearly an issue for the family and for young, Dutch, as he's called. He's not called Ronald, is he? Nobody calls him Ronald at this point. Everyone calls him Dutch.
Dutch after his hairstyle, a Dutch bob.
A Dutch bob, yeah.
But the salient fact about Jack Reagan and his drinking is that it affects his ability to work. And so they keep having to move town, and their lodgings become kind of poorer and poorer and poorer.
Yeah.
So there's a sense of a downward spiral, even as Dutch is, loving life. He's clearly a person with a great appetite for life.
Yeah.
But Jack never loses his principles. And Reagan remembers, he refuses to let Ronald Reagan has an elder brother who goes by the nickname of Moon. What's he called? Neil, I think.
Neil. Yeah. Neil. I'd choose Moon over Neil, frankly.
Maybe.
No offense to any Neil listeners. But Moon listeners will be delighted by that remark.
So Moon and Dutch are not allowed to watch Birth of a Nation, the very racist film when it comes out. And Reagan remembers, there was no more egregious sin at our household than a racial slur or other evidence of religious or racial intolerance.
Tom, your role with Reagan is very good. You were reluctant to do it before we started recording, and I really had to twist your arm and sort of shout at you to get you to do it. But I'm glad Ronald Reagan is joining us for this podcast.
So that I found really interesting reading up about Reagan's childhood was the omnipresent sense that Jack Reagan embodies a very kind of principled devotion to FDR,
yes,
New Deal, all that kind of stuff. That he's very opposed to anything that smacks of racial prejudice, religious prejudice. And on that topic, of course, it's interesting that he's a Catholic, he's married a Protestant.
Yeah, Nellie Wilson.
And that's very unusual, isn't it?
It is unusual. And Nellie is not, she's not just somebody from a Protestant background. So Jack is kind of, the big man, kind of tall and gregarious and stuff. And Nellie is more innocent, I suppose, and deeply, deeply religious. She joins a group called the Disciples of Christ. 1910. By the standards of sort of evangelicalish churches, they are they're very kind of moderate, aren't they?
But passionately committed.
Yeah,
to good works.
They sound a very attractive as sort of brands go. Christian brands go. They're a very appealing one, aren't they? They're devoted to the social gospel. The aim is that you do a charitable deed every day, which she does.
Yeah.
She really throws herself into it. Parts of the because Jack is off. Boozing and fitting shoes to the female.
Fitting the female foot.
So she is, and she goes on the road for the Disciples of Christ, and she does recitals, and she does sort of talks, and she reads Christian poetry, and all of that, undoubtedly, I had not appreciated until really digging into Reagan's background. I always thought his talk of God was skin deep, and it's patently obvious that it isn't.
And it's very young. He feels it very young.
Yeah.
Because it's a church where you have full immersive baptism. But you have to choose to be baptized. And both Dutch and Moon wanted to have it done very young.
They do.
And she agrees. And he always holds to it.
Well, he reads a book, which is a sort of Disciples of Christ fictional bestseller called That Printer of Udells by Harold Bell Wright. And there's the hero of that is called Dick Faulkner. And at one point he comes across his own father, who's an alcoholic, passed out, drunk. And this obviously made a big impression on Reagan because he has a story. It's always hard to tell with Reagan, of course, where his own recollections begin and, you know, fiction ends. But he has a story about doing that with his own father. And clearly this book, That Printer, had a massive effect on him because when he was 11, he went to his mother and said, please have me baptized in the Disciples of Christ. And again, as Europeans, I think in the 1980s, we sort of thought, oh, ha ha, this is all just completely fake and inauthentic and sort of pandering to his constituency. Not a bit of it. He genuinely, all his life, he takes this stuff enormously seriously, that faith element. So the combination of kind of Jack, charming, real hit with the ladies, you know, a man's man, I suppose you would say, a man who will have a glass of whiskey with you and tell you a kind of funny story. And then Nelly, really interested in sort of, you know, she's a performer, but she loves taking the stage and talking to people about good and evil, right and wrong, you know, the path of Christ. I mean, you can see them in Ronald, can't you?
And that, again, is the stereotype of Reagan in 80s Europe, is that he's a person who sees the world in Manichaean terms, who sees it in terms of good and evil. And this is something that I think isn't entirely wrong. I think Reagan is very, very prone to seeing the world in terms of good and evil.
Yeah.
And one of the, obviously, the his mother's church is a huge influence on that. But another one is his early love of movies. And this is a period where you can tell who the goodie is because he's wearing a white hat.
Yeah.
And you can tell who the baddies are because they're wearing black hats. And am I unfair in saying that that essentially establishes his understanding of how the world is?
I don't think you are unfair. I think he definitely has a strong sense that the world is a, you know, his antipathy to communism later in his life, you know, that is shot through with a very clear sense of there is good and evil. When he talks about the evil empire, the Soviet Union is the focus for evil in the modern world, as he does in 1983. That's not just a speechwriter talking. That's reflecting his deep sense, which actually he definitely shares with Margaret Thatcher, who also comes from a, by British standards, an unusually sort of God-fearing, low church kind of Methodist background. They bond over that because, you know, they when they're meeting with other kind of world-weary, you know, Helmut Schmidt, Helmut Kohl, these kinds of people, they probably don't go, Mitterrand, they probably don't go in for this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
Their moralism marks them out. And I think a lot of people actually, for both, it's true of both Reagan and Thatcher, but even more so for Reagan, I think his moralism and his Manichaeanism in the 1970s, a very confused sort of post-Vietnam period, I think a lot of people found that actually
reassuring.
Yeah, really invigorating to have somebody who stands up and says there's good and evil.
But I think also what people responded to later in Reagan's later career is the sense that he had really walked the American walk.
Yeah.
That he has the high school sweetheart, who's a girl called Margaret Cleaver.
Muggs. What a great name.
He plays sport. The basketball team he plays for is brilliantly called the Wiffle Puffs.
Yeah. Are they basketball or baseball?
Basketball. So he's playing basketball. He plays baseball.
But football is his passion. Football is the sport. He really, American.
Which he will then go on to play the Gipper.
Yeah, of course.
And he makes his money by serving as a lifeguard.
A lifeguard, yeah.
And that sense of kind of strapping health, high school, all that, you know, everything that not just Americans think about when they think of small town America. Reagan is living that life. And ironically, in a kind of, you know, he loves it.
Yeah. So people say about him when he's a teenager, people admire him, people like him. Nobody really knows him. Even then, I mean, all through his career, people say, you don't know Ronald Reagan. He doesn't share his feelings. He doesn't have, for example, close male friends. He has, everybody likes him, but he doesn't have a kind of a soulmate. I mean, obviously there's Muggs. He loves acting even as a teenager. He's into the church. I mean, it's interesting. His parents are kind of, it's later said of him that he makes guest appearances with his own family and his own children because he's always off doing something else. And that's true of his parents too, isn't it? Because by the time he's a teenager, his mother is at church, his father is in the pub or something.
Yeah.
And yet, a bit like with when we did our podcast about the young Churchill, it's an interesting lesson in the power of temperament, because Reagan could so easily have been bitter, you know, that his parents were, that they were never there, that his father was drinking, that their circumstances were so straitened. But he has this incredible optimism.
A sunniness.
Sunniness. So his high school yearbook, you write your own motto in your high school yearbook. And his motto is, "Life is one sweet song, so start the music." And for it is inconceivable that a British teenager would ever
listening
write
to the
those
Smiths.
Yeah, would ever write those words. I mean, it's just at no stage, I think, in Britain's history would anybody have said that sentence without laughing. But Reagan, you know, it's one of the attractive things about him. It's one of the reasons that actually is a pleasure to read about.
Yeah.
Because it's so unusual to have somebody so sunny and optimistic.
Yeah. And he ends up going to a college, doesn't he? Eureka.
Yeah.
Which is a great name for a college. Eureka College. Which it, again, has a kind of sunniness shot through it. It's very, very, it's very progressive.
Yes. Founded by abolitionists, disciples of Christ. Yeah.
And when Reagan goes, there's the orientation day. The guest of honor is a Civil War veteran who'd known Lincoln.
Crikey. Yeah.
That sense of that he's obviously got from his dad and that he gets from Muggs, who's gone there. And Reagan has to get a scholarship. I mean, he can't afford to go.
Mm.
Basically, they kind of chuck out scholarships to everyone because they're that kind of institution.
Yeah, and he's good at sports. Well, he's quite good at sports. He works really hard and throws himself into it. He's not very good at his academic work, is he? He sort of coasts.
Yeah.
Gets C's and D's or something.
But he's acting.
He's doing his acting. Even when he's on the football team, he will impersonate sportscasters.
Right. And he also apparently has a very good impersonation of FDR.
Well, he loves FDR, of course. So FDR is about to... FDR is not quite yet president, but FDR is the kind of coming man, is governor of New York. And the Reagan family adore FDR. And Reagan all his life thought FDR was the absolute model of a president. I'll tell you one thing, that an affectation he developed at Eureka College that I'm sorry he abandoned is smoking a pipe.
Well, and also the other thing that he, of course, abandons is wearing glasses, because he's incredibly short-sighted.
Yeah.
And I'd never realized that. You never see him with glasses, do
no,
you?
No, never. You would never appear in public as president. I mean, just like he wouldn't appear in public as president without a shirt and tie and a sort of full suit yeah. and booted. Yeah. He doesn't want to look like Jimmy Carter.
But that's why he could never be a truly elite sportsman.
Is, right.
You know, a bit like me. That,
but Tom, you wear glasses.
We have the natural ability. Yeah, because I just think that with my looks, I can get away with them.
So actually, the parallels are quite uncanny.
Yeah,
because
in many ways.
You're also, as people will have gauged from that George Gipp business, you're also a quite brilliant actor, aren't you?
Yes, yes, yes. Well, it's not for me to say, but very possibly.
Well, I read the feedback on your impersonations on Twitter from our listeners. Yeah. For example, what did you do recently? You did The Sopranos.
Yeah.
And extraordinary feedback, I think it's fair to say.
So I could have gone to Hollywood, as Reagan ends up doing, doesn't he? Because he doesn't play sport, so he decides to commentate on it.
Well, we should take a break, Tom, and then before we get into his sports casting career, because that is a remarkable story.
Okay.
So we'll see you after the break for some sports casting.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp.
Bottling everything up is never a good idea. It can have terrible consequences. For instance, look at all the conflicts throughout history. I wonder how many of them could have been solved if they just talked things out.
And Tom, I have a confession for our listeners. As you know, I've been really struggling with anxiety about the massive series that we've got coming on The Rest is History, all the prep we have to do for that series on the French Revolution, the First World War. I mean, it's all mounting up, isn't it? And when we talked it out, I felt so much better now that I got all those crippling anxieties and insecurities off my chest.
If you want to talk, you can always talk to me. But if not, then I highly recommend therapy. It can help you learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It empowers you, Dominic, to be the best version of yourself.
If you want to give therapy a try, why not check out BetterHelp? It's entirely online, it's convenient and flexible, and it's really easy to get started. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and they'll match you with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest.
with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/restishistory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/restishistory.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to The Rest is History. We're talking about Ronald Reagan. And Tom, it's 1932. The United States is in the depths of the Great Depression. One in four people are out of work. But not Ronald Wilson Reagan, because he is determined to Muggs, his girlfriend, has a dream they'll both be teachers. But he's not really interested in being a teacher. He's already interested in the kind of showbiz world, but the world of sport. So he goes off to
sports.
Sports. Yes, I'm so sorry. You take the S from maths and put it onto sport, and that's how you speak American. He goes off to Chicago, doesn't get in, tries to get his foot in the door, but doesn't manage it. But he ends up through various contacts in Davenport, Iowa, for the brilliantly named radio station World of Chiropractic.
Aha.
So, WOC. So the guy who owns it is BJ Palmer. His father invented chiropractic, apparently. And they basically give Reagan a trial, sort of off the cuff. He improvises commentary on a game that Eureka had played against Western State. And they say, brilliant, you know, they give him the job. And then he goes off to Des Moines, Iowa, for their sister station, WHO. And he rises to be their chief sportscaster, doesn't he?
Mm-hmm.
And he's actually brilliant at it. And the amazing thing is he never does any of the games. Well, he can't see any of the games.
He can't see it. Well, there's a famous anecdote that he tells later about, you know, this is coming, the details are coming through, and then it cuts out.
Yeah, for 6 minutes.
And so he just completely makes it up.
Yeah. And then when they come back on, so he's been delaying for 6 minutes and inventing fouls and stuff and describing the background. And then it comes back on to discover that the batter was out within seconds of the wire going down. So this is often taken by Reagan's more hostile biographers as sort of evidence of his addiction to fantasy and his a sort of dishonesty and artifice. But almost all commentary like this was done this way. So basically you would get the wire, telegraph wire, Western Union, and it would tell you what had happened. You had the crowd noise on a record next to you, and you described what happened. And of course, the brilliant thing was it had that classic sort of, as a British observer, that American thing of that love of inflating things. So you would just make the play as exciting and as dramatic as possible.
I mean, the key to that anecdote was that he didn't want to break the spell.
Yeah.
He didn't want to let light in. You know, and that I think is, I don't think it's unfair to say that that is pretty key to his character.
Yeah.
I mean, if there's a kind of a heartwarming fantasy, he doesn't want it punctured. And indeed, he goes on to kind of live it.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. So if you think of Boris Johnson doing that, I mean, he would be quite good at it at first, but he would be constantly winking at you and letting you know that it's all
leering.
That it's all a great joke, and he actually has never seen any of the games
because Reagan lives it. I mean, that's why it's not so much a lie as a kind of exaggerated truth, perhaps one might say.
Reagan is a great man for a parable, isn't he? For metaphorical truth, I suppose. Mm. He really believes in that. So anyway, the baseball is, it's great work. It's great training. He does it 6 days a week. He'll do 160 games in a given summer.
And he's talking, isn't he, to listeners? I mean, that's the other thing. He can talk to people as though it's a one-on-one chat to a friend.
Yeah. At a time when Roosevelt is doing his fireside chats to sell the New Deal to people. So radio is the medium through which you communicate. And Reagan, he's a local celebrity in Des Moines. So he's the kind of person who is a well enough known radio personality that they'll have his picture behind the bar in the local bar. And people say, oh, Dutch Reagan comes here.
And meanwhile, Muggs has gone off to France, hasn't she?
She has. She's
vanished.
Yeah, she's off the scene.
She's left. She's off the scene.
Readers of the Sporting News voted him the fourth best sports announcer in the United States. So this is often told as like a two-bit story. He's in the middle of nowhere. But he has millions and millions of listeners across the Midwest. So I think the Des Moines Dispatch said, to millions of sports fans in at least 7 or 8 Midwestern states, the voice of Dutch Reagan is a daily source of baseball dope. That's like how people talk about you, Tom. History dope.
Yeah, that's good, isn't it?
Yeah.
History dope.
That's what we should have called the podcast.
Yeah, we should. we could yet.
But so he could easily have done that. He could easily have done that all his life and gone down as a much loved, you know, retired in the 1970s or 80s as a much loved local.
Would have been played by Kevin Costner in a mid-90s film.
Maybe he would. Yeah. Dutch Reagan, the greatest sportscaster. But that's not enough for him. He goes off with the Cubs in 1936 when they're spring training in California. And then a year later, he goes again and he has a friend that he's met through WHO, who's called Joy Hodges, who's an actress and singer. And they have dinner and he says, he just comes straight out with it and says, I would love to be in Hollywood. You know, he's in his mid-20s.
Of course he would.
You know, I'd love to.
I mean, of course he would.
And she calls her agent, who's called Bill Michael John. And her agent meets him and says, yeah. He could do it. He's tall. He's handsome. He says, I mean, Reagan does have a magnificent voice. He has the most wonderful, sonorous, warm voice.
And he's also all his lifeguarding. He's a very good swimmer.
Yeah.
So he's got the physique.
Yeah.
I mean, he's a very good looking man.
He is. He's got everything. I mean, this agent, Bill Michael John, he basically takes one look at him and he rings Warner Brothers and says, I have another Robert Taylor for you. And they do a screen test and they offer him a 7-year deal.
Warner's offers contract, 7 years, stop, 1 year option, stop, starting $200 a week, stop.
Yeah. And Reagan says, famously, bite the hand off before they change their mind. That's sort of nice little bit of self-deprecation, kind of, that he's very good at. That's a lot of money. I did the conversion. In today's money, that's about $10,000 a week.
It's not bad, is it?
So that's not bad at all. He's a big enough fellow in the Midwest that WHO throw him a farewell party and the mayor of Des Moines goes, the state treasurer of Iowa. Yeah, so he's not a nobody at all.
No.
And then he goes off to Hollywood. And by Hollywood standards, he's never a really big star. So he's got a contract. If you had a contract with Warner Brothers, you're one of about 100 people, of whom maybe 20 to 30 are the big stars. And then there's 70 others who are the kind of contract players.
So he's always B-movie, basically.
Yeah.
And he's always the best friend.
He is always the best friend.
So the Gipper, I mean, the Gipper isn't the lead in the film, is it?
No, he's not. It's a sad moment when the Gipper dies, but the film is about Knute Rockne. It's about the coach. So, yeah, he works 6 days a week, 5 in the morning till 6 o'clock in the evening. But he's lucky because he has a friend, because the big gossip columnist of the day, Luella Parsons, who writes for the Los Angeles Examiner, one of the Hearst stable of papers, she is from Dixon, Illinois. So she takes a real shine to Reagan and boosts him up. So
it's the Midwest Mafia.
Exactly. Yeah. The Dixon Mafia. People never talk about them controlling Hollywood, do they? He's doing all these sort of B movies. So they're about 1 hour long.
I mean, unbelievably, he plays Custer.
Does he play Custer?
He does. Opposite Errol Flynn, who's playing Jeb Stuart. And Errol Flynn will then go on to play Custer 2 years later in They Died With Their Boots On. And Errol Flynn looks much more like Custer.
Reagan's the last person I would.
He doesn't have a beard. He doesn't have a moustache. He doesn't have the long golden curls. I mean, he looks nothing like Custer.
And his personality is always the sort of sturdy, reliable, loyal, decent, the soul of the American Midwest.
Yeah.
That's what he plays. And Custer doesn't really fit that description.
No, not at all.
At all.
So that's miscasting. And then he plays a guy who loses his legs, doesn't he?
In King's Row. That's his most...
Where's the rest of me?
Yeah. So actually, his two most famous moments both involve him lying down.
And dying. Yeah, kind of throat infection, lost limbs. Gorbachev had watched King's Row.
Had he?
Yeah. And so when they met in Geneva, and Reagan was saying to Gorbachev, actually, you know, everyone says that I was just a kind of not a very important actor, but I was quite famous. And Gorbachev said, yes, I saw you when you played someone who didn't have any legs.
What a bizarre.
Brilliant, isn't it?
I mean, he was. So the thing with Reagan and acting, I mean, it's so many people have pored over this. He was never a kind of A-list big name. He was always a supporting actor. People will sort of say, especially in the 80s when his critics would say he was a terrible actor, a B-movie actor. I mean, he wasn't terrible. Otherwise, he wouldn't have
got the contract.
He wouldn't have got the contract.
But also, he raises his profile in two ways, doesn't he? So the first is, and this is where the gossip column comes in, that he marries Jane Wyman.
Yeah.
The time they start going out together, their careers are about on a par. But in due course, she'll win an Oscar. She'll become...
Well, she's nominated for an Oscar. Yeah.
I think she wins an Oscar in due course after the war.
Oh, you're absolutely right. You're right. And I stand. She doesn't just win an Oscar. She's got two Golden Globes and two Remys.
Yeah, so she ends up a massive star. And I think that becomes part of the problem because, of course, spoiler alert, that Reagan and Jane Wyman end up divorcing. And it's Jane Wyman who wants to do it. And I think that the kind of disequilibrium between the grabber of their respective careers is part of that. But Jane Wyman has a very kind of Marilyn Monroe-esque confusion of names, kind of broken upbringing. And she and Reagan, you know, that's a kind of great partnership because the gossip columnists can write about it and all that kind of thing.
But they're very ill-suited though, aren't they, Tom?
Don't you think? Incredibly ill-suited. I'm so bored with him, I'll either kill him or kill myself, she says at one point. And she's always complaining about his verbal diarrhea.
She just says, what did she say to him at one point when they break up? It's actually, I'm just going to try and find the... I came here hoping you changed, but you haven't. You're still the same loudmouth you were before.
Because by this point, Reagan has discovered Reader's Digest.
Yeah.
And he just motors his way through it and he will just repeat it. And so he's endlessly going on to Jane Wyman about dams in Africa and ocelots and all kinds of stuff.
Is he talking about ocelots? I don't, surely not.
That's the kind of thing you get in Reader's Digest.
He's full of facts. Everybody always says, and they say this right through to January 1989 when he leaves the White House. They say the trouble with Reagan is if you write something down and hand it to him, he will believe it. I mean, all his aides say it drives them mad that he reads stuff in magazines. And is so there's one famous example where he says that trees cause more pollution than people do. Yes. And he's read it somewhere.
In the Reader's Digest.
Yeah, and he cannot be persuaded that it's not true.
But the thing that's interesting about Jane Wyman is that she was always a Republican.
Yeah. Right.
So Reagan was the liberal and she was the conservative.
Yeah.
And so actually, you know, long after they've divorced, she votes for him in both elections. And Dominic, here's a link to the Cathars episode, perhaps unexpected.
Oh, okay. This is unexpected.
So when she died, she was buried in the white robes of a Dominican nun. So she was a Dominican.
Buried at Rennes-le-Château.
No, she wasn't.
That would be a
no.
Heck
well,
of a
who
twist.
Knows? Who knows what truth? Maybe she was a grand mistress of the Priory of Sion.
Possibly. But she's completely wrong. She's very fiery. She's sort of quite a turbulent character.
Yes, she's typecast as a kind of, you know, she's in screwball comedies. She's a kind of wisecracking dame, that kind of stuff.
She's a floozy. She's a floozy is what she is.
And she wants to get out of that and play more complicated, more subtle characterization. And she succeeds in doing that. Reagan never does that. And I think part of it is that maybe he's a more limited actor. But I think also it's because actually he can't play more complex characters because he's not a particularly complicated character. Do you think?
Yeah.
Was that harsh?
I don't think, no, I think that's right. I think lots of people say about him, he only basically plays himself. Hal Wallace who runs the Warner slate. So he's in charge of managing the sort of the Warner team. He says he's not an actor of depth or intensity.
Yeah.
And lots of people basically say, Ronald Reagan will play the best friend, but anything more demanding,
anything
than
more subtle. Yeah.
So actually, in King's Row, where he loses his legs, he had hoped that would be the springboard to playing more, you know, more demanding parts. But that's 1941. The war intervenes, and there's a bit of a hiatus in his career because he goes off to join the Air Corps. That's when he does a lot of his Reader's Digest reading, because he's sort of working as a backroom boy. He's too old, really, to fight. He has a dependence by that point, so Jane, and they've started a family. So Maureen, and then they end up adopting Michael.
But again, the weird thing, so there's this brilliant comment by Stephen Vaughan on Reagan, that no 20th century president, with the exception of Dwight D. Eisenhower, had been seen in uniform by more people.
Because he's appearing in all these propaganda films.
Because he's appearing in propaganda films.
Yeah.
So he's kind of playing a simulacrum of an American officer in the war.
Yes, he is.
And he does it so brilliantly that it comes to seem indistinguishable from the reality.
Well, I mean, it's Reagan who institutes, for example, saluting when he's president, always saluting the Marine Guards and all these kinds of things. And he's brilliant at it, and he looks very military. But he's always quite conscious, I think, that he didn't see action in the Second World War, that actually he spent it behind a desk through no fault of his own. Even, I mean, among other things, his short-sightedness means that he would probably have been found it very hard to get a sort of front line.
Well, I think, I mean, I think when we come to the account of his the assassination attempt on him, it will be very clear that Reagan was, you know, was certainly not a coward.
No, not at all.
I mean, he was a very brave man. But again, it's this bleeding of reality into fantasy and back again and role playing, so that it kind of becomes indistinguishable. But one thing, so I talked about the two things that raise Reagan's profile, despite the fact that his acting career isn't entirely stellar. So one is his marriage to Jane Wyman. The other is that he starts to get into Hollywood politics, doesn't he? And specifically union politics.
Yeah.
And again, so Reagan is the only, I think, the only US president to have been a union leader.
I think that's absolutely right. Yes. He comes out of the war, and the demand for his kind of parts is drying up, actually. Because in the late 1940s, people want more conflicted, grittier films. And he's just not right for those. You know, he's from the late 30s, melodramas. He doesn't fit. And he throws himself into the Screen Actors Guild. He's always been, I mean, this is, again, this is something that reflects his deepest impulses. Going back to his mother in, you know, when he's growing up in the Disciples of Christ, you always join in, you know, you're the person. So he'd always been the union rep, the union monitor from about 1938 onwards on most of the films he had done. You know, he was a union man.
And does it well, and it's very popular.
Yeah, he's very popular. But union, Hollywood union politics is very, very conflicted in the late 1940s. So there are a whole series of strikes. The studio bosses are swinging to the right. So people like Walt Disney, for example, are really, really banging the drum of anti-communism. And in part because they're very cross about the strikes, and they basically want to present the strikes as communist-inspired. There is a key moment from 1946. It's not the actors themselves. It is the people who build the sets and, you know, do all the sort
painters
of... painters. All the hard graft. So they'd been represented by something called the International Alliance of Theatrical and Stage Employees. But there's a breakaway union called the Conference of Studio Unions. That the sort of the left, the more left-leaning actors are keen to back. This dispute gets really quite vicious. So the September 1946, more than 1,000 of the sort of painters and decorators and builders and things are fired. And the question is, who are the actors going to back, the studio bosses or the kind of the craftsmen? And Reagan delivers a big set piece speech in a 6,000 seater stadium to all, you know, the Hollywood actors, basically, in October 1946, in which he persuades them that the strike is being led by communists and they shouldn't get involved.
He gets police protection after that, doesn't he? Because there's a threat that acid will be thrown in his face.
Exactly. It's very sort of conflicted, sort of time of dirty politics. The House Committee on Un-American Activities are looking into Hollywood, putting pressure on Hollywood, saying, you know, you've made far too many pro-Soviet films in World War II. There are far too many communist writers. There's this sort of suspicion of a communist cell within Hollywood and so on and so forth. And Reagan becomes the president of the Screen Actors Guild in March 1947, at the point at which all this is really, really hotting up. And he has no doubt whatsoever about his role. His role, as he sees it, is to stand up for the American way, to cooperate with HUAC, cooperate with the FBI.
But at the, I mean, so he's becoming, I mean, very openly anti-communist, but at the same time, he is very effective at representing the interests of his fellow actors against the studio bosses, right? I mean, he's, to that extent, he's still very recognizably the disciple of FDR, the admirer, you know, his father's son.
Yeah, he's still voting Democrat. So he votes, he's still voting, he's voted for FDR. He's, I guess, must vote for Truman in 1948. He's not confrontational with the studio bosses. So he would always cut deals with them.
But he's popular with...
Yeah, with the other actors.
With the other actors who vote, because they see him as effective.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. They definitely don't regard him as the studio boss's puppet. I think there are definitely questions later on about whether he's a little bit too close to his own agency, MCA. So a really powerful Hollywood agency. But you're absolutely right. He would not have been propelled into that position as the head of the Screen Actors Guild had he not been regarded as a guy who will fight for a better deal.
Yeah.
For the actors. The question mark that hangs over him is, you know, he goes and testifies to HUAC and so on and so forth in late 1947. What he does is, it's classic Reagan. He's brilliant at pleasing everybody, giving everybody. So he goes in front of the committee and he says, well, there are some communists in Hollywood, but he doesn't name any names. He says there are communists, but we've got them under control. You know, we'll root them out, because he's sort of trying to protect. He's simultaneously giving the committee what it wants while also protecting the Screen Actors Guild and protecting the sort of the great majority of actors. So this is the point at which you have the blacklist of the Hollywood 10. Those people who won't cooperate with the inquiry, they are put on a blacklist and they can only work under sort of false names and stuff. Reagan has no interest in standing up for them, which some people do. He's absolutely not going to go out on a limb to do that. But he's sort of charting, it's not quite a middle course, because his anti-communism is becoming increasingly sort of marked. But it's not, I think it would be unfair to say he's just a sort of rabid red baiter or something, as later right. critics sometimes did.
But over the course of the 50s, he is definitely drifting to the right.
Yeah.
So anti-communism is combined with a resentment of the tax burden, as he sees it.
Yes.
Because isn't there something that he'd... something to do with he'd expected a tax amnesty after the war, which he didn't get.
That's right. People had had them in World War One. If they veterans had been able to defray their taxes till the end of the war. Either he's read it in the Reader's Digest or he's got a very bad accountant who says they'll probably do the same again. So he doesn't pay his taxes. And then basically that forces him into the highest possible tax bracket at the end of World War Two. And he's outraged. He's also, Jane Wyman has asked him for a divorce. So he's paying alimony to her because she gets the kids.
And his career is starting to to go down.
Exactly. His career is starting to go down. Plus, he's sort of hanging around with a lot of actors who are very right-wing. So Robert Taylor, Robert Montgomery, George Murphy. They're kind of actors of a certain age. They're maybe a couple of years older than Reagan. They kind of look like Reagan. They sort of sit around
craggy.
Sort of a lot of Brill Cream. They sit around drinking scotch and sort of moaning about paying too much tax and, you know, their swimming pool. And
do you think in Reagan's case, you know, as his career seems to be going down, that is his politics being bred of resentment, do you think?
He can never understand why his film career doesn't work out. I think he always thinks he was a better actor and he never really got a... It's why he's very prickly later on when people mock his acting. He doesn't mind doing it himself, but he doesn't like other people doing it. And
yeah,
I think it's because
I can relate to that.
Oh, you're like that about, you know, cricket, history.
Yeah, a lot of things. Yeah, no, I certain fellow feeling.
Yeah. No, I think you're right. I think there's a sense in which life at this point is the first point in his life where he's not getting everything, you know, ambition and hard work are not taking him to the places.
Yeah.
That he thought they would.
And just to reiterate, I mean, they have taken him a very long way.
Oh, yeah.
He's from a very poverty-stricken background, and he kind of has been living the American dream, but the American dream now is slightly curdling.
Yes.
And so his film career is coming to an end, and so therefore the question is, what is he going to do?
Well, when we come back next time, we'll talk about the one person who he hasn't yet met, who definitely is going to confirm his move to the right, who is not from a poverty-stricken background by any means, and that is, of course, Nancy Davis, who becomes his great sort of soulmate and his partner. But just before we bow out, Tom, I mean, the lowest point in Reagan's life, he goes to London in early 1940.
Yes, he does, and it's the first foreign country he's ever been to, isn't it?
And he thinks it's terrible.
It confirms all his darker suspicions of socialism.
He's shocked by the socialism of Clement Attlee's Britain. Do you know what he described London as? A dismal wilderness, Tom. That's how I feel about London. So, you know, he had some steaks flown over to the Savoy because he thought the British food was so bad. And I read...
But to be fair to us, though, that's because we'd been bombed and...
But he says to Richard Todd, his co-star at one point, what is rationing? He kind of can't get his head around it. He has these steaks flown over, but the fridges in the Savoy apparently didn't work properly, so the steaks all went bad. Anyway, that confirms all his darkest fears about European-style socialism and socialism.
It's lucky his great-great-grandparents didn't stay in Peckham then, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, gosh, yes.
A bullet dodged.
That is a bullet dodged. Right. We will come back and we will be talking a bit more about Nancy. We will talk about Reagan's move to work for General Electric, his involvement with the Barry Goldwater campaign in 1964, becoming governor of California, and then his rise to the presidency. And then after that, we will get on to the presidency, to Gorbachev, to Iran-Contra, all these things.
So we're looking at three episodes, aren't we?
Oh, definitely, Tom. At least. So if you want to listen to them right now, the great news is that actually you can.
It's a great offer.
You should be selling this in your Ronald Reagan voice. Do you want to sell it? Where can they listen to them, Tom? On which platform?
My fellow Americans, they can listen to it on every platform. It's a great offer. So what you want to do is you want to subscribe on Apple Podcasts or restishistorypod.com. Apple Podcasts or restishistorypod.com.
And if you don't do that, you'll just have to wait along with the European-style socialists.
Yeah. That's the Democrat option.
You'll just have to wait.
A bunch of loser commies,
you'll just have to
don't pay us money.
I see myself very much as the who am I in this analogy?
Who are you? Nancy.
I'm not Nancy. I was just about to say I'm not Nancy. I'm somebody like Lemuel Boulware of General Electric.
So you definitely want to go and sign up because, honestly, the list of characters with ludicrous and improbable names coming up is not to be missed. So basically, pile in.
So next time, the life and career of Lemuel Boulware on the rest of history, and also a bit of Ronald Reagan. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thanks for listening to The Rest Is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, please sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.